Hello, and welcome to Designing Education Podcast. In today's episode, we'll be talking to Richard Lofton about what we learn when we talk with students and parents about their educational experiences and put their insights at the center of our improvement efforts. We can't wait to jump into this conversation. But before we start, we want to take a moment to remind you to subscribe to the Designing Education Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We're available on Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts, just to name a few. Subscribe to Designing Education and never miss an episode. Welcome to the Designing Education Podcast Series. I'm Dr. Robert Balfant, Director of the Pathways to Adult Success Program and the Everyone Graduate Center at Johns Hopkins University. I'm delighted to have you join us today. This is the seventh episode in a series of conversations we'll be having with educational leaders, thinkers, and practitioners from across the country. We'll talk about what will it take to create an education system that truly empowers all young people and sets them on a pathway to long-term success. In today's episode, I'll be joined by Dr. Richard Lofton, assistant professor and leader of the Nobody Asked Me campaign at the Center for the Social Organization of Schools, School of Education, Johns Hopkins University. When we think about designing education to meet the needs of the 21st century and provide everyone a robust pathway to adult success, we typically draw on two sources: the adults involved in the current education system and our own experiences. Education is the one field where just about everybody considers themselves an expert because we all have deep lived experience going to school. Both of these, however, can be conservative forces. They can result in an education system that is much less dynamic than the world around it. Who we often overlook, and as our guest today says, don't even ask, are the students currently in school and their families. Yet they are the most informed observers of where new designs are needed, what they might be, and the challenges we need to address. This is particularly true for the communities and students for whom the current education system works the least. Communities and students who live in areas where residential segregation, structural racism, and disinvestment have produced concentrated poverty and underfunded school systems. It is at the intersection of place, history, and student voice that our guest today is doing an inventive work to ask those who nobody has asked and connect their knowledge and insights with a growing coalition of community groups and policymakers to redesign the most broken aspects of our education system. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we dive in to this deep and important topic, we'd like to start by asking all our guests, when you were in school, what was a good day?
I would say a good day for me is the day that they would have the cheese pizza. I'm a foodie. I love food. And when they would have the cheese pizza and it was cooked right, I would be extremely excited. But that was when I was in middle school. But what came with the pizza was the noon aide as well, who watched over us, but did it in a loving, nurturing way. Miss Jones, I still remember her name today. So for me, it was getting that nourishment as well as connecting with people who worked in school that knew about who my mom was, who my family members were, my older brothers who went to the school, as well as community members. That was a good day for me when I would see her smile at the same time be able to eat a slice of pizza.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Really at the heart of that, right, is feeling cared for and connected. Right. And, you know, there's a lot of research that supports that, but that lived human experience drives it home. If we feel cared for and connected, that's a good day. Let's get into the work, Richard. Can you tell us a bit about the Nobody Asked Me campaign, how it works, and what it seeks to do?
The Nobody Asked Me campaign aims to do four things. First, it aims to illuminate the voices and experiences of students and their parents in ways that allow them to be social agents. The second is highlight their experiences, their struggles, their dilemmas, their solutions, and how it impacts their educational experiences. The third thing is it breaks down silos. We acknowledge why, because of concentrated poverty and racial segregation, that many of the institutions have actually separated social actors and did not allow them to actually connect in certain ways. So our work tried to connect community leaders as well as interagency leaders as well as students and parents and administrators to really address the issues that students are encountering. The fourth thing is to really acknowledge that there are promises that we must fulfill when it comes to education. When we think about equity, as well as the state educational constitution of a thorough and effective education, we try to find ways to address that. So it's really four things, you know, illuminate the voices, highlight the struggles, break down silos, also fulfill the promise.
Thank you. And just what I want to add is when Richard does this work, he digs in deep, right? So Richard, you're well over 100 interviews now with students and families in your most recent sort of round. Is that right?
So we have conducted over 165 interviews right now, and our data is really rich, and it gives us the opportunity to really understand what students are encountering when they live in concentrated poverty, as well as go to schools that are underfunded.
Let's dig into some of those results now. And I'm going to begin with what I'm going to call a lightning round, just because your results are so rich and so deep that we could probably have three or four episodes, and maybe we should, around each one of your core findings. But I'm going to begin by sort of calling out three of the key themes that emerge, and just ask you to give us like a summary of a big finding, and then also a little bit of like, you know, what insights emerge from that about what we might do about it. So the first one is safety. What do we learn about from safety from talking to our students and our families?
You know, it's really interesting. Most of the time when we talk about safety, we're thinking about interpersonal violence and harm that is done to individuals, or peers are doing something to each other, or students are doing something to a teacher, or something that's happening in a community. I found that. But I also found, you know, doing this work of how we have to also look at the social and emotional violence that students are encountering every day. But not only that, how structural violence is connected to the interpersonal violence, and the interpersonal violence is connected to the social and emotional. So that's one thing, and we probably could get in that later. But just to give a understanding, when I say structural violence, I'm looking at the inability to supply the resources and opportunities that are needed to survive. So when you have that, you have this fight or flight that I see many students are experiencing. And that connects to the social and emotional. But then also, at the same time, with this fight and flight situation that is going on, we also have this interpersonal violence as well.
And, you know, one of the findings that stories you've told that really struck with me is that, you know, often it's particularly elementary students will walk to school, and how they have to be so thoughtful about the path they're taking and sort of be ever vigilant about what's in front of them, where they're walking, and how that when they get to school then puts them in a very heightened state of sort of anxiety.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly they're supposed to be able to, you know, calm down briefly and like get to work.
Right. And then teachers will like for them to sit down and be quiet. You right. know, but then also when you think about transportation back and forth to school, doing the work in Baltimore, our students do not have nice yellow buses to get back and forth to school. And so we found that our students are actually more vulnerable to crime and violence by taking these regular public buses that everyone else take. But not only that, we're finding some really serious issues with, you know, sexual harassment. But then often we look at students being late and tardy, and we kind of blame them or their parents, but we're not looking at it in a way of there's other agencies and other institutions that are involved that are hindering the educational experiences of students.
Yeah. And I think that's another really profound example that, you know, in many of us went to school in yellow buses, and we maybe walked to the bottom of a street and were picked up and then dropped off in front of the school. But in urban environments like Baltimore and others, where they made deals way back in the 1960s with a mass transit, regional mass transit system, they take the city bus, but city buses aren't designed for school bus routes. And drivers have a lot of discretion about who they stop and when they stop. And that can put lots of kids at the mercy of things beyond their control. But then when they walk in that building, we tend to act like, well, it's your personal responsibility to get in school on time, and not acknowledging that they were tried very hard, but the system we gave them totally failed them.
Absolutely. And when you think about Baltimore, you think about how unreliable the buses are in Baltimore, as well as, you know, when it comes to the public transportation and the long routes that students are encountering. I mean, many times students would tell me they get up at 5 o'clock in the morning or, you know, or earlier, just trying to get to school because it takes an hour and 20 minutes or takes a long time. So really thinking, once again, these basic assumptions when it comes to getting students to school, but yet the role of education and how do we educate students in the century that we are in today?
Yeah. So that brings us to sort of a third key finding, which was that, you know, students get stressed getting to school, they both either for safety or transportation. And then when they get to school, they walk into a learning environment. And what do we learn about that learning environment from your work?
That these learning environments are not necessarily all that healthy. They're not healthy and they're not safe. They are learning environments where students' basic needs, you know, are in jeopardy. I mean, not having drinking fountains. Some schools have rodents and some schools, toilets do not work, or they go to the bathroom and there's no toilet tissue. There's no soap. There's no doors to close the toilet. So no privacy. So we're finding that infrastructure is a really huge issue that our students are encountering. And it's not just like, you know, just the toilet and things like that, but also during the winter is extremely cold, you know, and during the summer is extremely hot. So these extreme temperatures, all this we know through social scientific research, is impacting the educational experiences of young people.
I mean, and that's what really stands out, right, from so much of what what was learned when you actually ask students, what is your day-to-day experience? And their parents, they talked about the most basic things, like the things that we generally assume are in place, right? That, you know, can I get to back and forth to school safely? Is my transportation reliable? When I get to school, it'll be not too hot or not too cold or a roof that doesn't leak. And, you know, so much of our reform efforts are built on the assumption that all that works. So we can then, of course, spend our time in what ultimately is the most important, which is good teaching and learning. But with this, what we learn when we listen to the students themselves, as they're saying, is that the environment, the conditions under which teaching and learning happens can be so difficult and so sort of unjust and so poorly designed to meet basic needs that gets in the way of all those other efforts. And we're not paying attention to this sort of like foundational needs.
Absolutely.
Was there anything that I know you talked to all these students, was there anything that really just sort of blew your mind, you know, about when they shared, like, this is the thing that really needs to change?
You know, one of the students, just going on this learning environment, I interviewed him, young African-American. I think he was like in 11th grade, and his name was Don. And, you know, he told me about his life where his father, you know, passed away, and his uncle was raising him at one point, and then he went to jail. And then after going to jail, they sent him back to Jamaica. But what was so interesting about that is at the end of the interview, I was asking him, like, what do you want me to highlight? What do you want me to try to bring about the change? You know, what topic? And he said, can you make sure that, you know, I'm safe and I have clean toilets, like a toilet? And it shocked me. And, you know, Bob, I'm really emotional. Right. I care about people and students and things like that. So it hit home for him to tell me that. And so it really made me think that young people see what is going on and they want change, but they're also asking, why is this allowed to occur to me?
Yeah.
And that's something I think we should really think about.
Yeah. Yeah. It just sort of stuns you. Like, why is there more, you know, more like protests in the streets or something, that, like, you know, the most basic things aren't being given yet? You know, we as you point out, the Maryland State Constitution gives everyone a constitutional right to sort of a free and efficient education. So I want to go a little deeper now. A fourth area that your work looked at was this idea of pathways from high school to adult success. The very thing our learning community for this podcast is built around. Can you share a little bit about what you learned about students' aspirations for their futures?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I discovered is often we feel like young people do not have aspirations, you know, or they only want to be football or basketball players. That wasn't true in my data. I have no issue if they want to be a football or basketball player, because when I was young, I wanted to be a football and basketball player and a singer and all those great things, too. But I didn't necessarily find that in the data. What we did find is high aspirations. So students did want to, you know, become, you know, psychologists. Students did want to become, you know, a doctor. Students wanted to become very traditional job roles, you know, and it was very clear that they knew that there were certain jobs that would help them financially get out of poverty or financially help them with economic success. What we also found was these were traditional jobs. So there were multiple jobs that we have in the job market, and our young people really were not aware of the jobs that are actually in the job market today. Not only that, we also discovered that within the schools, there was no effective pathway to really help our young people actually take the right classes and be on the right track and have the support and resources behind them. So high aspirations, but at the same time, not really having the structure to need it in order to support that.
Yeah. And that really gets me to my next question, or even go deeper, which is that, you know, a key part of your work is that comparing these aspirations to the reality students face. And you're already going there. And one thing that you and I actually worked together on this was trying to figure out how many pathways are needed. How many places do we need for our graduating seniors? So they have somewhere good to go after high school that will get them to a family supporting wage. Mm-hmm. And we came up with something on the order of like 3,000, there's 3,000 graduating seniors each year and each and every year in Baltimore. And to help our listeners out, Baltimore is a school system about 70,000. So you can use that to think about your own districts. So this is about half the graduating class, right? Doesn't really have a pathway to adult success, doesn't currently exist. And what that really drove home is that in order to provide opportunities for all and to have a pathway to adult success for all, we really have to create new pathways. This is not just about improving a little bit the ones we have, or adding a few more, you know, apprenticeship slots, or a few more, entry level opportunities. That, you know, 3,000 is a lot, and it's every year that they need a place to go and don't have it. So, can you share some thoughts about what might be involved in meeting this need?
Absolutely. I also want to just step back a little bit and acknowledge how smart humans are. Right. And think about the aspirations of their grandmother and their mother and then them. Right. And acknowledge that we live in a world where students, particularly in Baltimore, once they get out of high school and graduate from college, it doesn't guarantee that they actually will get, you know, will get out of poverty. You know, I think there were statistics that we're seeing that the majority of the ones who actually graduated after, you know, 8 years, I mean, 6 years from college, I think it was 6 years from high school when they graduated from college, they still were making under $20,000. And so the majority of them, I think it was like 75%, was making less than $20,000. And a good chunk of them just were not involved in the market at all. So I want us to start thinking, when we think about education, it's connected to employment and guaranteeing employment as well. Because we have a history of betrayal, right? We have a history of unfulfilled promises. And why should I work my butt off in school knowing that there's a chance and a big chance for me not to necessarily get the job that I would like to get. So I think we have to look at this not only from looking at students, but look at employment, look at hiring practices. Who are we hiring? You know, in Baltimore, very few people who graduate from the school district actually have good paying jobs. That's a problem. Right. But we look to education to solve so many issues. I think we have to also look at other industries and how they are connected, as well as employers who are employing, how it's connected to education as well.
Yeah. And one of the things we also talked about is that, providing sort of real avenues to entrepreneurship, not just sort of easy out, like, oh, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and make your own way. But, entrepreneurship means access to capital. It means access to expertise. It means access to people who can help you with business planning.
Absolutely.
We're very comfortable now providing students with some federal funding in the form of Pell Grants, mm-hmm. and various things to help, go to college if that's their choice, even if it's not the right perfect fit for them at that time. And they ultimately maybe don't, because of family needs or lots of reasons, don't earn a degree. We're still willing to invest that money.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to, do some mindset shift to say in some certain cases, maybe that's better spent helping them, start their own business, right? Because one of the things we know, right, from the neighborhoods they're in is that they have a shortage of goods and services.
Absolutely.
Right? And so there's actually a market for what they could provide if people provided them access to and the ability to start, real businesses.
Well, yeah, there's so much beauty and there's so much in these communities. And for us to keep an economic market going in these communities rooted in the people who live there, that is promising, extremely promising. And it would never solve all of the issues, right? But we'll have more people working. It will have more people connected to really embodying an educational experience that will meet some needs later on. And also allow people to see that, students need certain skills and understand that, young people are looking at all of this and trying to make sense of all of it.
It's another one of your areas of your work that I also find fascinating, this idea of institutional betrayal. Right, that the various institutions that are supposed to be designed to help them have often betrayed them. So they're not going to buy an easy promise anymore.
Thinking about Du Bois, when he talks about this double consciousness or this two-ness, right? I discovered that African-Americans and particularly Black Americans in Baltimore are so American. So they buy into that meritocracy, even if it blames and shames them and they connect it to their Blackness, right? But at the same time, they're fully aware of the racial oppression and the historical issues that young people are encountering. So it's one of those things where they're blaming themselves and also they're acknowledging the racial oppression that they are encountering as well.
Yeah, and that you're really good at leading us into each of our next topics intuitively here. Which...
Well, I learned from the best mentor possible. So,
so another critical part of the Nobody Asked Me campaign, and I think a thing that actually really distinguishes the work you and your colleagues do, is you actually connect this very present moment. Let's talk to the people that are experiencing this now in real time and understand their lived experience and their insights on how to make it better. You combine that with actually a deep historical analysis of how the lived environment that's shaping their views got there. So you're really combining this on the moment with history, right? Which is we often don't combine those things. And I think it's very powerful that you do. So can you talk to us why it is important to do that, to connect current reality with the history that shaped it?
Today, I believe that Black people in Baltimore are encountering a double quarantine. And it's been this persistent quarantine since they've been in Baltimore. But it really was articulated by the mayor in 1910 when he stated Blacks should be quarantined, but not only that, they should be in isolated slums, and they cause, disease and they cause violence. And I think that in many ways, we're still facing some of that, some of those issues today. It's really deeply rooted in many of the consciousness of the city and of the state particularly. And I think young people are fighting it. And we've had laws over the years to make sure that they stay quarantined, right? And policies. So when you think about, you know, the 1900s early with the racial covenants and the redlining that took place right after. And then you think about the disinvestment in Black communities today, and then schools where they are not getting the resources that are needed. So those words that the mayor said many years ago is manifested today in some of our policies. And being fully aware of that is something that I think we do not talk about enough. And I think if once we start addressing some of those issues in a healthy way, we'll actually meet some of the students' needs, as well as making sure that we produce the pathways for academic and also economic success.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what the result of this, right, is that when we're in a community, right, that's sort of experienced, 100 years plus of sort of, you know, structural racism and residential segregation mm-hmm. and disinvestment and concentrated poverty, it does make that a place that's different from places that have not experienced that. And sometimes we because we're not aware of that history, or we're just vaguely aware of it, or we really have made that strong connection that your work makes, we tend to discount that. We tend to say a kid's a kid. You know, kids have universal needs, and we don't, you know, we can just sort of, you know, it's sort of an easy false approach to equity, right? You know, a kid's a kid, that we give everybody what they, you know, the same thing, and that's equal opportunity. But, you know, that lived experience is so different, and it extends to, you know, everything you brought up, that like, no, in a lot of places, you know, kids do not have to be thinking every step as they walk to school, are they making the wrong step? They don't have to, you know, be left in the cold in the rain because the bus passed them by. They don't have to sit in a school where they shiver, you know, or they can barely breathe because of the heat. Right. That's a very different set of experiences. And also, you know, as you point out, that even the school system doesn't control a lot of those most basic elements. Like, the school system does not control the buses in Baltimore. It's controlled by a metropolitan transit authority that isn't really invested directly in the city of Baltimore. Right. It's invested at a much more regional level. So what kind of challenges is that, you know, when the lived reality of a place is very different from that of often neighborhoods right around it? What challenges does that present in mobilizing the coalitions we need to bring about real change?
Just to keep on going what you were saying, because I think you're completely right. Like, there's multiple layers of change that needs to take place. And to get back to what we were talking about earlier, it is that structural change that needs to take place, right? With the resources, opportunities, but then also that social emotional change of acknowledging the history and the harm that it has done, and making students believe they belong, as well as their Blackness, their humanness, their studentness is also valued and important. And we look at them as learners as well, you know, because it's, once again, it was grandma, mom, and now me, right? Dealing with the same issue. Grandma had to deal with the white flight. Mom had to deal with just separate schools where there were very few white people with resources. And also they are encountering, you know, tracking, ability grouping, and different things like that. So it continues. So we want to hit that social emotional piece of you are valued, you belong, and you are intelligent, and you are a student, not a thug. You know, the different stereotypes that young people actually tell me. I mean, one student told me in my earlier study, I've been called everything but a student. You know, so we got to hit that social emotional piece rooted in the experience of young people. But then not only that, you know, that interpersonal as well, and making sure that our students, as well as administrators, as well as teachers, do not blame them for things that they had no control over. Right. And I think a lot of what I'm finding in the data, once again, is because once again, Black people are so American. They're more American than most Americans. They buy into that meritocracy. right? And it's really rooted inside of them. And so I think that that's some of the issues that we're dealing with is we have so many injustices that are going on and people start blaming other people instead of looking at the structural issues and how that relates to the interpersonal and also connect to the social and emotional of individuals.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And really in closing now, I want, you know, we've talked a lot about challenges, but your work also highlights the incredible strength of students and their families. And you've talked a little bit about this, but I'd like you to sort of end there with us and leave us some thoughts on just the strength that comes through when you talk to students and their families.
You know, it's so amazing because Baltimore for students, you know, as much as they encounter, you know, racial segregation and a whole lot of racial oppression and things over the years, they find beauty in their city. They find beauty in their voices. They find beauty in their churches and different places that they go. And so they're not looking at Baltimore as necessarily this crime place and this place with so many structural inequalities, which they are aware of. But many of the young people look at this and love the city for what it is, you know, and they have built strong, meaningful relationships and they are able to have friends and socialize and do multiple things. You know, they have joy. They're happy about different things that's going on in Baltimore. So they're proud of their city as well. They just want to make sure that they get the resources and opportunities needed. And they are humanized through politics, you know, and they're viewed in ways where they are accepted for who they are. And so we found that there's a place where people are resisting. You know, this is one of the things that, you know, I also have issues with some people. We forget about the agency and the resiliency that we find in Black communities. And then we hit them on the head and say, you need more agency and more resiliency. The resiliency and agency is there. What they have overcome emotionally, what they have overcome socially, what they have overcome through structural violence is amazing. Even through police brutality, they're able to overcome and find ways to actually humanize themselves and actually find ways to create art, you know, create music, create dance. You know, many people are, you know, doing many things, developing their own social clubs. So as much as we talk about this place, you know, as dealing with a lot of racial issues, we also must acknowledge the beauty, the elegance, the wonderfulness that's in the community that allow people to get up every day with a smile.
Thank you, Richard. That's a beautiful way to end a very powerful conversation. And as we close out, are there any last words you'd like to share with the audience or let them know where they can learn more about what we discussed today?
Yeah, absolutely. We're still conducting research and we're still continuing to understand the experiences of young people and their parents. And we're working together with policymakers as well as teachers and administrators to bring about that change. So feel free to go to the website, nobodyasksme.org, find out more about the Nobody Ask Me campaign. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. To bring our discussion to a close, I'd like to thank Richard again for sharing what we learn when we ask those whose schooling is designed for, where we must do better, and how it can be done. As we seek to design schools that work for all students, the Nobody Ask Me campaign shows us how imperative it is to not only incorporate student and family voice at the center of our work, but to also recognize that different communities have different experiences and histories which need to inform our redesign efforts. What Richard's work makes clear is, if we fail to do this, we will fail to design better schools, and in so doing, continue to deny opportunities to those who have been denied them the most. Before we let you go, we want to ask you to please subscribe to Designing Education to stay up to date on all the revolutionary work happening in education. If you're enjoying this show, please leave us a 5-star review. And also, please share the show with a friend or a colleague or on social media. This has been Robert Balfance from the Everyone Graduate Center and the Pathways to Adult Success Project, thanking everyone for listening, inviting you to listen to the other episodes in our Designing Education series wherever you listen to podcasts. Onward and be well.